This is episode 98 of the Christian Research Journal Reads podcast. Was Ayn Rand Right? Capitalism and Greed by J.W. Richards. This article first appeared as the cover article of the print edition of the Christian Research Journal, volume 32, number 4, in 2009. To read the full text of this article and its documentation for free, please go to equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Was Ayn Rand Right? Capitalism and Greed by J.W. Richards. Synopsis. In response to the critics of capitalism, many conservative Christians turned to philosopher Ayn Rand for ammunition. Rand was a staunch defender of capitalism, but also an anti-Christian atheist who argued that capitalism was based on greed. Greed, for Rand, is good. But if Rand is right, then Christians can't be capitalists because greed is a sin. Fortunately, Rand was wrong. She missed the subtleties of capitalism. First, we should distinguish self-interest from selfishness. Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, famously wrote, quote, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest," end quote. True enough, but that alone isn't a problem. Every time you wash your hands or look both ways before you cross the street, you're pursuing your self-interest. But neither activity is selfish. Second, Smith never argued that the more selfish we are, the better a market works. His point, rather, is that in a free market, each of us can pursue ends within our narrow sphere of confidence and concern, our, quote, self-interest, end quote. And yet, an order will emerge that vastly exceeds anyone's deliberations. Finally, Smith argued that capitalism channels greed, which is a good thing. The point is that even if the butcher is selfish, he can't make you buy his meat. He has to offer you meat at a price you'll willingly buy. So capitalism doesn't need greed. What it does need is rule of law, freedom, and human creativity and initiative. And we can point that out without any help from Ayn Rand. If you're over 40, you probably remember the 1987 movie Wall Street. Michael Douglas played the key role, a ruthless corporate raider named Gordon Gekko. Gekko is famous for his defense of selfishness. Quote, "Greed is good," end quote, he tells a young broker. Quote, "Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all its forms, has marked the upward surge of mankind," end quote. Gekko embodies the enduring stereotype of the greedy businessman. Given the coverage of the 2009 financial crisis, it's no surprise that 20th Century Fox produced a sequel. Many people, including many Christians, believe that financial crises is the product of greedy capitalism, pure and simple. Others, including many Christians, want to defend capitalism, but end up drawing on the work of philosopher and playwright Ayn Rand, who called greed a virtue. That puts most of us between the proverbial rock and the hard place. As if in response, some prominent evangelicals such as the late Tony Campolo, Jim Wallis, and the late Ron Sider have criticized capitalism as based on the, quote, greed principle, end quote, to quote Campolo. And it's hard to blame them, since even many fans of capitalism such as Rand seem to agree. And certainly for Christians, greed is not good. Greed, selfishness, or avarice is one of the seven deadly sins. And the Bible has nothing good to say about it. In the Gospels, when Jesus was asked to settle an inheritance dispute, he responded, quote, Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions, end quote. Luke 12:15 TNIV. The 10th commandment says, quote, do not covet, end quote, which no doubt applies to greed as well. Jesus includes greed with murder and idolatry in a long list of sins, Mark 7:21-22. Paul tells the Ephesians that no greedy person, that is an idolater, he explains, will inherit the kingdom of God, Ephesians 5, ESV. These are just a few of the dozens of biblical passages condemning greed. So, what do we do? Must we embrace Rand's anti-Christian philosophy to defend capitalism? Or must we reject capitalism because it's based on greed? I don't think we have to do either. The truth is much more interesting and much more encouraging. The Beehive. Rand wasn't the first one to identify capitalism with greed. That honor goes to a Dutchman named Bernard Mandeville. In 1705, he wrote a poem called The Fable of the Bees. Nobody noticed it. So in 1714, he republished it with a lengthy commentary explaining that the poem was a metaphor for English society. Mandeville saw humans and bees as little more than bundles of vicious passions. The parable reflected that belief. In the beehive, different bees do different tasks, but they all have the same motivation, vice. The poem describes avarice, pride, and vanity as producing great wealth for the hive. The bees, however, are discontent. They grumble at the lack of virtue around them. They gripe so incessantly that Jove eventually gives them what they ask for. Honesty and virtue now fill the hive, and everything collapses. The bees' virtuous actions led to disaster, whereas the individual acts of evil had led to social good. Taken literally, Mandeville's claim is ridiculous. Good doesn't come from evil. Virtue isn't born from vice. Virtue doesn't destroy society. Still, he did get one thing right. Bad intentions don't always yield bad results. Recall that the Apostle Paul once delighted that some were preaching the gospel out of envy of him. He didn't delight in the envy, but in the preaching. So even private sinful acts may lead to a social good. The virtue of selfishness? After Mandeville came the Scottish philosopher Adam Smith, who in 1776 wrote the most famous book in the history of economics, The Wealth of Nations. Though the book is long on pages and detail, its basic purpose was simple. Smith wanted to defend what he called the natural system of liberty, rule of law, unobtrusive government, private property, specialization of labor, and free trade. To prosper, society needed, quote, little else, end quote, he said, but, quote, peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice, end quote. But so far from flattering the business class, Smith famously said that, quote, people of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion. But the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public, or in some contrivance to raise prices, end quote. Not exactly a ringing endorsement. Smith never credited the happy outcomes of trade and business to the virtues of business people. Quote, it is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker, end quote, he wrote, only to be quoted by every economics textbook ever written, quote, that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest, end quote. Nevertheless, through the invisible hand of the market, individuals will, quote, promote an end which is no part of their intention, end quote. That end often benefits society overall. If you don't read Smith carefully, you might think that he's making the same argument as Mandeville: individual greed is good for society. That's a misreading of Smith, which was made wildly popular by Ayn Rand. Then comes Rand. Perhaps more than anyone else, Ayn Rand not only identified capitalism with greed, but defended it in those terms. She even wrote a book called The Virtue of Selfishness. For Rand, greed was the basis for a free economy. Capitalism and greed go together like fat cats and big cigars. To prevent readers from thinking she was using hyperbole, Rand went out of her way to espouse atheism and stridently denounce Christian altruism as antithetical to capitalism. Quote, "Capitalism and altruism are incompatible," end quote. She said, quote, "They are philosophical opposites. They cannot coexist in the same man or in the same society," end quote. In fact, she had a hard time distinguishing Christian altruism from socialism. Rand was born in Russia in 1905 as Elisa Zinovievna Rosenbaum and immigrated to the United States in 1925, just as communism was securing its stranglehold on the Soviet Union. Her hatred of the collectivism she saw in her youth was etched into her worldview, her writings, even her strange personality. After coming to the U.S., she worked as a scriptwriter in various Hollywood studios. The release of her novel, The Fountainhead, in 1943 made her famous. Atlas Shrugged, published in 1957, made her a sensation. In her novels, she developed characters that expressed her philosophy, quote, of man as a heroic being with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life, with a productive achievement as his noblest activity and reason as his only absolute, end quote. Her books read more like tracts for her philosophy of objectivism than ordinary novels. As Daniel Flint puts it, quote, the themes of Rand's four novels, We the Living, Anthem, The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, are identical. As far as the philosophy of her novels go, to read one is to read them all, end quote. But for millions of readers, her books still inspire. I discovered Rand during my senior year in college. Her books were like a blow to the chest. She mercilessly skewered every leftist cliche that I had taken for granted. I found her bracing prose and iconic heroes attractive and repellent at the same time. For a few months, she seized me. I frittered away a week of my senior year reading Atlas Shrugged rather than studying for a German final. The book tells about an elite group of creative entrepreneurs and investors, quote, individuals of the mind, end quote, who go on strike against a state that implements the communist principle, quote, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, end quote. For Rand, these entrepreneurial heroes, like Atlas in Greek mythology, hold up the world. By pursuing their long-term self-interest, they create value for everyone. So when they shrug, that is, strike, society begins to decay. The hero of Atlas Shrugged, John Galt, founds a secret community off the collectivist grid called Galt's Gulch. Here in this New Jerusalem, individuality and self-interest are prized above all else. One long chapter of the book, quote, this is John Galt speaking, end quote, is nothing but a speech by Galt. It's the perfect distillation of Rand's philosophy. Despite Rand's official praise of selfishness, however, John Galt doesn't look anything like Ebenezer Scrooge or that fat, cigar-smoking, tuxedo-clad guy Monopoly. On the contrary, Galt is a pioneer, a brave creator of wealth, who pursues his vision despite powerful obstacles, including a malevolent state bent on destroying him. In fact, although Rand despised Christian self-sacrifice, Galt is suspiciously Christ-like. He preaches a message of salvation, founds a community, challenges the status quo and official powers that be, who hunt him down, torture him, but ultimately fail to conquer him. To be sure, there are dissonant notes. His symbol is not a cross, but the dollar sign. The book ends with Galt and his lover tracing the sign of the dollar across a dry valley. But insofar as Galt's character works, it's because he contradicts the miserly stereotype that Rand's philosophy leads the reader to expect. In fact, not one of Rand's best fictional characters fits her philosophy very well. Rand convinced me that collectivism was a false moral pretense. She also taught me the importance of entrepreneurs in creating wealth. Rand knew better than some economists that you can't have capitalism without capitalists. Rand continues to be popular with some conservatives, including some Christians. Based on my brief description of her work, that might seem unlikely, but the lack of robust moral defenses of capitalism has left a void, and for many, Rand has filled it. That's a problem, of course, since her philosophy as a whole is clearly incompatible with the Christian worldview. Fortunately, we don't need Rand's philosophy to defend capitalism. Capitalism and Rand's defense of it are two different things. This is clear once you realize that Rand bought into a myth more common among critics of capitalism, that the essence of capitalism is greed. Selfishness and self-interest. Some 30 million books by Rand have been sold, and more than 500,000 copies of her book are still sold every year. In a poll conducted by the Library of Congress and the Book of the Month Club in the 1990s, Atlas Shrugged came in second behind the Bible as the most influential book. Although her work is best known in the U.S., it's read around the world. Perhaps it's not surprising that many conservatives, including many Christians, embrace her. They think they have nowhere else to go. Who but Rand made industrialists the heroes of novels? Whatever the reasons for her popularity, however, she completely missed the subtleties of capitalism. Her hatred of Marxism and collectivism led her to defend a caricature of capitalism more grotesque than anything Marx imagined. Her praise of greed is the reduction to the absurd of a bad interpretation of Adam Smith's concept of self-interest. Smith, a moral philosopher, didn't goad butchers, brewers, and bakers to be more selfish. He believed that normal adults aren't self-absorbed monads, but have a natural sympathy for their fellow human beings. His point about self-interest is that, in a rightly ordered market economy, you're usually better off appealing to someone's self-love than to their kindness. The butcher is more likely to give you meat if it's a win-win trade, for example, than if you're reduced to begging. Smith isn't suggesting that butchers should never help beggars. Smith was a realist. He wasn't naive about the motives of merchants and everyone else. In fact, like most academics, he harbored snobbish prejudices against business. He knew the difference, however, between self-interest and mere selfishness. Smith believed humans are a mixed breed. We are pulled to and fro by our whims and passions, but we're not a slave to them, since our passions can be checked by the, quote, impartial spectator, end quote, of reason. We are capable of vices such as greed, and virtues such as sympathy. Unlike Mandeville, moreover, Smith didn't view all our passions as vicious. We may be passionately committed to a just cause, for instance. At the same time, he saw greed as a vice. So while he agreed with Mandeville that private vices could lead to public goods, he was an ardent critic of the Dutchman. Quote, there is, end quote, he said, quote, another system which seems to take away altogether the distinction between vice and virtue, and of which the tendency is, upon that account, wholly pernicious. I mean the system of Dr. Mandeville, end quote. You'd never catch Smith endorsing Ayn Rand. For Smith, pursuing your self-interest was not in itself immoral. Every second of the day, you act in your own self-interest. Every time you take a breath, wash your hands, eat your fiber, take your vitamins, look both ways before crossing the street, take a shower, pay your bills, go to the doctor, read a book, and pray for God's forgiveness, you're pursuing your self-interest. That's not just okay. In most cases, you ought to do these things. In fact, proper self-interest is the basis for the golden rule, which Jesus taught, the second greatest commandment after the command to love God, quote, in everything, do to others as you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets, end quote. Matthew 7:12 NIV. I'm supposed to use my rightful concern for myself as a guide in how I treat others. This makes sense, since I know best what I need. Quote, every man is no doubt by nature, end quote, Smith said. Quote, first and principally recommended to his own care, and as he is fitter to take care of himself than of any other person, it is fit and right that it should be so, end quote. Self-interest isn't just looking out for number one at everyone else's expense. Since we're social beings, our self-interest includes our friends, families, communities, co-workers, co-religionists, and others. When I pay my bills, I'm not just pursuing my narrow interest, but the interests of my family, my bank, my community, and whomever I'm paying. I choose my church and my neighborhood and my car, not just for myself, but for my children. Mostly for them, in fact. If I were childless, do you think I would drive a gray Honda Accord? Most of your choices involve the interests of others, too. Self-interest has to do with those things we know, value, and have some control over. I'm most responsible for what I do. Smith's point was not that the more selfish we are, the better a market works. His point, rather, is that in a free market, each of us can pursue ends within our narrow sphere of competence and concern, our, quote, self-interest, end quote. And yet, an order will emerge that vastly exceeds anyone's deliberations. The same would be true even if we did everything with godly rather than mixed motives. The central point is not our greed, but the limits to our knowledge. The market is a higher level order that exceeds the knowledge of any and all of us. Falling into capitalism. So contrary to Rand, capitalism doesn't need greed. At the same time, it can channel greed, which is all to the good. We should want a social order that channels proper self-interest, as well as selfishness, into socially desirable outcomes. Any system that requires everyone always to act selflessly is doomed to failure because it's utopian. That's the problem with socialism. It doesn't fit the human condition. It alienates people from their rightful self-interest and channels selfishness into socially destructive behavior, such as stealing, hoarding, and getting the government to steal for you. In contrast, capitalism is fit for real, fallen, limited human beings. Quote, in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity, end quote, Adam Smith wrote, business people are, quote, led by an invisible hand, and thus without intending it, without knowing it, advance the interest of society, end quote. Notice he says in spite of. His point isn't that the butcher should be selfish or even that his selfishness is particularly helpful. His point is rather that even if the butcher is selfish, even if the butcher would love nothing more than to sell you a spoiled chunk of gristly beef in exchange for your worldly goods and leave you homeless, the butcher can't make you buy his meat in a free economy. He has to offer you meat that you'll freely buy. The cruel, greedy butcher, in other words, has to look for ways to set up win-win scenarios. Even to satisfy his greed, he has to meet your desires. The market makes this happen. That's making the best of a bad situation and of a bad butcher. Does capitalism make people greedy? Even if capitalism doesn't need greed, doesn't it feed greed? Many religious scholars don't even distinguish capitalism and greed. Capitalism is just greed elevated to economics, or so they think. To be sure, Rand and other champions of capitalism appeal to greed, even glory in it. There's no evidence, however, that citizens of capitalist countries in general, or Americans in particular, are more greedy than average. In fact, the evidence suggests just the opposite. Of course, Americans should be more generous, more loving, more thankful, more thoughtful, and less sinful. If you look, you can find greed all across the fruited plains and in every human heart. That's because we're fallen human beings, not because we're Americans or capitalists. Every culture and walk of life has heaping helpings of greedy people. There are greedy doctors, greedy social workers, greedy teachers, politicians, park rangers, and youth pastors. That's why greed can explain why capitalism works no better than it can explain the universal thirst for, say, well-synchronized traffic lights. Greed is universal. Capitalism is not. The gift givers. Think of a stereotypical miser like Ebenezer Scrooge, as opposed to the ordinary greedy person. Misers hoard their wealth. They hole up in their bedrooms counting their gold bullion and hiding it in mattresses. Quote, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal," end quote, Jesus commanded his disciples. Quote, "But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also," end quote. Jesus is talking about the person who hoards, who trusts his possessions rather than God. Quote, "You cannot serve both God and money," Matthew 6:19-21 and 24, NIV. The Apostle Paul said that greed is idolatry, Ephesians 5:5. If religion involves our ultimate concern, as Paul Tillich said, then the miser is an idolater. He worships his money. That's because you can only have one ultimate concern. Many of the biblical warnings seem to apply to misers, but how many misers have you met? Do you know anyone who keeps a bag of money in his mattress where he can count it? Probably not. We see misers on TV, read about them in children's books and in Dickens. In capitalist societies, however, misers are in very short supply. That's because capitalism discourages miserliness and encourages its near opposite, enterprise. Quote, "The grasping or hoarding rich man is the antithesis of capitalism, not its epitome," end quote, writes George Gilder. Quote, "More a feudal figure than a bourgeois one," end quote. The miser prefers the certainty and security of his booty. Entrepreneurs, in contrast, assume risk. They cast their bread on the waters of uncertainty, hoping that the bread will return with fish. They delay whatever gratification their wealth might provide now for the hope of future gain. The miser treats his bullion as an end in itself. The entrepreneur, whatever his motives, including the desire for more money, uses money as a tool. The carpenter uses hammer and saw. The doctor, scalpel and stethoscope. The entrepreneur, cash and credit. Only by the constant din of stereotype could we come to mistake the entrepreneur for the miser. In his modern classic, Wealth and Poverty, George Gilder explores a surprising feature of enterprise. Supply precedes demand. After all, before you can exchange, you must first have something to exchange. I must have a good of service, a coconut or a potholder, or an iPhone that someone wants in order for trade to ever get started. Right off the bat, if I'm an entrepreneur, I have to think about the wants and needs of others. In a free economy, great entrepreneurs, including greedy ones, succeed by anticipating and meeting the desires of others. In that sense, Gilder argues they are altruistic. Alter in Latin means other. Entrepreneurial investments, he argues, are like gifts, since they are made without a predetermined return. Competition between entrepreneurs in a free economy thus becomes an altruistic competition, not because the entrepreneurs have warm fuzzies in their hearts or are unconcerned with personal wealth, but because they seek to meet the desires of others better than their competitors do. Not for nothing did Ayn Rand dedicate her final lecture to a tirade against Gilder. But her view of the capitalist in the end was skewed by the Marxist stereotype she had officially rejected. Gilder's view captures much better the nature and subtlety of entrepreneurial capitalism. Far from requiring vice, entrepreneurial capitalism requires a whole host of virtues. Before entrepreneurs can invest capital, for instance, they must first accumulate it. So unlike gluttons and hedonists, entrepreneurs set aside rather than consume much of their wealth. Unlike misers and cowards, they risk rather than hoard what they have saved, providing stability for those employed by their endeavors. Unlike skeptics, they have faith in their neighbors, their partners, their society, their employees, quote, in the compensatory logic of the cosmos, end quote. Unlike the self-absorbed, they anticipate the needs of others, even needs that no one else may have imagined. Unlike the impetuous, they make disciplined choices. Unlike the automaton, they freely discover new ways of creating and combining resources to meet the needs of others. This cluster of virtues, not the vice of greed, is the essence of what Reverend Robert Sirico calls the, quote, entrepreneurial vocation, end quote. I'm convinced that Ayn Rand continues to be popular in part because she dared to make entrepreneurs the heroes of her novels. Whatever her other failings, this was a keen insight. Without entrepreneurs, very little of what we take for granted in our economy and our everyday lives would exist. Here in my office, the concrete forms of entrepreneurial imagination are everywhere. Paper, scissors, pens, highlighter, ink, an empty Tupperware container that held the pork loin I ate for lunch, a flat screen monitor, fonts, lamps, light bulbs, post-it notes, windows, sheetrock, speakers, a laptop computer, and an optical mouse. Behind all these visible objects lay real, but less visible innovations in finance, manufacturing, and transport that I can scarcely comprehend. All of these things are gifts of entrepreneurs. Only the most miserly moralizer could look at the mysterious efflorescence of cooperation, competition, and creativity of entrepreneurial capitalism and see only the dead hand of greed. Does that mean if you're a Christian, you must embrace capitalism? No, but it does mean that Christians don't need to adopt Ayn Rand's anti-Christian philosophy to defend the morality of capitalism. Once we comprehend the nature of entrepreneurial capitalism, we see that it has fit within the Christian worldview all along.
Thank you for listening to another episode from the Christian Research Journal Reads podcast, which provides audio articles of Christian Research Journal articles. If you go to equip.org, you will find a brand new article for the Christian Research Journal published weekly. In addition, please subscribe to our other podcasts. Wherever you find your favorite podcasts, you will find the Christian Research Journal Reads podcast, the Postmodern Realities podcast, which features interviews with Christian Research Journal authors, our flagship podcast, the Bible Answer Man broadcast, and the Hank Unplugged podcast, where CRI President Hank Hanegraaff takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting and informative people on the planet. At equip.org, you will also find a lot of resources to equip you, including many thousands of Christian Research Journal articles. That's EQUIP.org.